The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. I'm the author of the News Dissector blog at newsdissector.com. I'm the editor of mediachannel.org. I'm a writer, I'm a filmmaker, I'm a troublemaker, and I've been your host on News Dissector Radio for the past every Friday at this time. I'm just going to start with a little announcement. I am off to South Africa next week, so I won't be on the air for maybe as long as a month or so. I'm also going to the Zanzibar International Film Festival, which is a very cool place. Back in the 60s, the United States government was trying to compare Zanzibar to Cuba. They were afraid that there might be a revolution in Zanzibar, and there was a lot of talk about that. At any rate, I'll be visiting Zanzibar for the first time and also going to South Africa, a country that I've been engaged with since the 1960s. Some of you may remember I produced South Africa Now, a television series that was on public television across the United States. I also was one of the key people who made the Sun City video and album calling for sanctions against South Africa back in the late 80s, working with Little Steven and Arthur Baker and Bruce Springsteen, Bono, and others. And so this has been a passion of mine for many years, and I've been going back to South Africa over maybe every year and a half, kind of keep in touch with what's going on there, to see old friends, to see how that new democracy is emerging with a lot of problems, of course, but it is emerging. And I'll be able to report from there. I'll be blogging from there once I get set up. But for the next probably week or two, I won't be blogging and I won't be on the radio here, at least not live. So I wanted to report that. This week and today in my blog on newsdissector.com, I talk about the effort to try to undermine financial reform. After the financial crisis, everybody said, oh my goodness, we need reforms, we need regulations, we need to make sure this can't happen again. This led to a bill called Dodd-Frank. It was like the mountain gave forth a mouse, you know. They came up with this measure, and then they waited. In the measure was, you know, an effort to create rules, new rules for Wall Street. And little by little, piece by piece, the people on Wall Street have lobbied this whole bill into the ground, essentially niggling it, trying to redefine the definitions so that they will benefit them and all the rest of it. They mounted a lobbying campaign with 25 lobbyists for every member of Congress. And now the big fight is, can will we establish a consumer protection bureau, which is started as out as an independent agency, became a bureau within the Federal Reserve Bank. The question is, who's going to run it? And most of the people who care about consumer protection and financial reform want Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard professor, to direct it. She's the one that proposed it. And now it looks like the Obama administration wants anybody but Elizabeth Warren in order to wheel and deal with the Republicans. And as a consequence, they are not supporting her. I call this a betrayal in my blog on newsdissector.com, and I would like your comments and thoughts about all this. Today in the New York Times, as I follow this financial crisis, Paul Krugman has hit it on the nail again, talking about how, while unemployment is the biggest problem in the country, the administration is unwilling to do anything about job creation, is not basically initiating any new efforts to create jobs. The Federal Reserve isn't as well. And he puts this down to the influence of various influential groups, people he calls rentiers, or the people who own the bonds, who are the credit financiers, who are basically saying nobody should get anything until we get paid, even though they've made risky investments, even though they've benefited when others have lost jobs and homes and the like. And Krugman is all on this today. The reality, he says, creditor-friendly policies are crippling the economy. This is a negative-sum game in which the attempt to protect these rentiers from any losses is inflicting much larger losses on everyone else. And the only way to get a real recovery going is to stop playing this game. That's Paul Krugman in the Times. I agree with him, but I also believe more needs to be done to bring the banks under our control. And this is something I write about, so check out my column today. There are a couple of articles about various efforts to penalize the banks, which are, you know, pretty pathetic as far as I can see, fines against Goldman Sachs and the like. Anyway, I'm not going to get into this in any detail because I'm thrilled to have Russ Baker with me. Russ Baker is a leading investigative journalist. He's going to tell us more about what he's doing. He's joining us from the online news conference in Orlando, Florida in just 1 minute. Stay with us. Country Joe on the Foot and the Fish singing about Vietnam, words that are relevant today when we look at what's happening in Libya, a conflict that's really been unexamined by and large by our media, who's benefiting from this war and who's losing. One of the people who's been looking into this in some detail is our guest today, who is really a brilliant investigative reporter, and he's joining us from Florida, but also Russ Baker. Also, there's a big article by Matt Taibbi and Rolling Stone about this as well. So we're going to be discussing the U.S. relationship with Libya and the findings of Russ Baker's latest investigation. Thanks for joining us, Russ.
Always a pleasure, Danny. We have a new article up in the past week on our website, which, if I may give...
Please, plug.
It's whowhatwhy.com. Every day we put up a new piece of analysis or investigative reporting. And on Who, What, Why, we put up this article about Libya. Basically, I've been for months trying to figure out what the real story was there, because the original claim that the U.S. and NATO were going in there to protect civilians just didn't make any sense. That is not a general policy either of the United States or of NATO. And
well, not only that, Russ, they said they were going in there, it's going to be over in a couple of days.
Right.
We're going to protect these civilians and then we're out of there. United States is not going to send troops. I mean, just today, the outgoing defense Department Secretary Gates basically has blasted NATO, who is our big ally, who supposedly is running the war in Libya, of course, with American support. So
with American push. But the thing is, I was always trying to figure out what are they doing there? Why are they going in there? And we've written a few articles on Who, What, Why about that, talking about the importance of the oil in Libya, which is pretty obvious. But I really wasn't able to put the pieces together until recently, when I started examining and doing what I think you do very well as well as a news dissector, which is to dissect bits and pieces being reported in the mainstream corporate-owned press. And the best stuff usually in these papers is buried at the bottom of the article. And so I take a bunch of those things and I juxtapose them, and here's what I find. I find that essentially my conclusion is this, and I can back up over the specific evidence. My ultimate conclusion from my reporting is that back when the Arab Spring started, there was tremendous and understandable panic in Washington about the most important thing of all, which, of course, is oil, and it was a threat to the oil supplies and the overall stability of the U.S. presence in the Middle East, because if these dominoes were to keep falling, we would find ourselves entirely pushed out. And so I try always to put myself in their shoes and imagine, what would I do? Well, what I would do is I try to get ahead of the curve on this thing. Now, that's what I think Libya is. They said, look, there are all these revolutions happening. Why don't we get in and have our own revolution? And that, I think, is what happened. I think it was absolutely brilliant. And if you go through our article on Who, What, Why, you can see all of the particulars. You can see them right from the beginning. Just as Mubarak is toppling in Egypt, they're looking at the country next door. They're moving in, and they're starting to do things. They're putting in pieces. They're putting in a general to run the troops, a man who had been living right near CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, for more than a dozen years with no visible means of income. They started a very serious propaganda campaign to convince the public that Gaddafi was somebody who was just so beyond the pale that he absolutely had to go.
And the new Hitler.
Well, right. We can talk about the particulars on that. That in itself, studying the propaganda campaign, is very, very interesting because you can see all the hallmarks of the traditional PSYOPs, military, CIA.
Yeah, I mean, just recently on this particular point, the most recent story that surfaced from the ICC, the International Criminal Court, were charges that Gaddafi was shipping vats of Viagra into Libya in order to have a mass rape campaign. Okay, Amnesty International looked into this and couldn't confirm it, could not find evidence for it. Our former Congresswoman McKinney, who is in Libya right now, while Libya is being bombed, has been writing about this every day, and she produced an article from 2008, which was charges that the U.S. was using Viagra to give to the Taliban to try to encourage them to keep fighting in Afghanistan. I mean, so it was like almost an identical article. But this one was about what the U.S. was doing as opposed to what Libya was doing. But this article, which has so far not been confirmed by anybody, has been accepted by almost everybody in the media because, in a sense, Gaddafi has become the latest person that's being demonized, the person we now love to hate. We need a Gaddafi. We need a Saddam. We need somebody to focus attention on so to justify what we want to do.
Well, if we have time, I want to come back to this propaganda effort to target him. But there's another part of this story, and this goes to the sorts of important work that you've been doing on money and banks and so forth, and that is this. Two very important events reported by other media but not getting sufficient attention. The first is that in 2000 and I want to say 2008, when all the economic, well, actually I think this began in 2007, as the economic collapse began, Goldman Sachs went into Libya after all the sanctions had been dropped against Gaddafi over the Pan Am 103 bombing. They went in and they started working him. He welcomed basically the international community in because they wanted to invest their sovereign wealth fund in more lucrative investments than just in banknotes and normal debt. And so Goldman Sachs went in and they sold him $1.3 billion, I should say Libya, $1.3 billion in options. According to the Wall Street Journal, Goldman Sachs somehow managed to lose, are you ready, 98% of that investment. Now, I don't know technically how that's even possible with options, but in any case, Gaddafi was furious, and understandably so, because even though he, like all leaders, I think, of those countries, and probably leaders of most countries everywhere, certainly pockets plenty himself, but they also do have funds that they use to provide public services. You can't have a government without that, and so they can't afford to lose $1.3 billion like that, and so he was furious, so angry that according to this journal report, Goldman Sachs had to bring in some security people to help get their people out safely. Now, that's one thing. Now, what I put that together with is another story that the following year, this was buried in a New York Times article, Gaddafi called in the representatives of the major foreign oil companies in Libya and said, I need you guys. You're not paying enough in the way of royalties. Now, according to the way that the Times presented it, he was saying, look, I have to pay all this money on this Lockerbie bombing, restitution payments to the families, and it's too much money, and I need you to pay more. And the way the Times presented it was just that this was a shakedown by this guy, this bomber, to the oil companies unfairly, but in fact, I think it's something very, very different. And I think when you connect it to the Journal story, you see that he was trying to recoup. He thought he'd been ripped off by Goldman Sachs, and he was trying to recoup it from these oil companies who he also felt were ripping him off and not paying enough. Now,
and there's another angle to this, which Taibbi mentions also, which is an unnamed Goldman banker apparently said that Goldman a few years ago offered Gaddafi a $3.7 billion stake in Goldman Sachs. And the deal was never struck, but nevertheless, the fact that it was offered at all is itself shocking.
Well, you see, Danny, that came after they lost him the money. Basically, they went to him, and you talk about chutzpah, they went to him and they said, look, sorry we lost all this money for you, but we can make it back for you. How'd you like to basically take a giant stake in our own company? And we will pay you. They're promising him a payout of about 6% a year, and so over quite a number of years, they'd be able to recoup the money. But I think that that's a very interesting story. There are also allegations that Goldman Sachs was essentially bribing, government officials there, I think including some members of Gaddafi's family. But to me, here's the crux of the main story. This is a man. You have to go back to the Lockerbie bombing because, people around the world, the two main propaganda points against him, one for certain people is that that Libya was allegedly behind the bombing of this Pan Am 103 and the deaths of all of those civilians. The second claim against him is this stuff about rape. And you remember this: the first rape allegation that came out was this woman who broke into this hotel in Tripoli where all the reporters were sitting around looking for stories and began yelling that I've been raped by Gaddafi's security forces. They, of course, had nothing better to do. They jumped on it. This story went all over the world. Now, rape is a terrible, terrible thing, but you have to be careful with these things because, first of all, it's very rare that rape victims want their faces and names made public. It's almost unheard of in the Arab world. She came from the rebel-held territory to Tripoli, made this claim. I've been trying to follow that story because there's been no good follow-up on it. What proof was there of that? She and her family want to come to the United States. And so here's this story goes all over the world. There was no evidence that Gaddafi himself had anything to do with it, although now they're starting to spread this story that he personally ordered it, related to the story you talked about with the Viagra. This is very, very dangerous stuff because, I mean, just logically speaking, I'm not saying we know for sure that he didn't do that, but I don't see what gain he could possibly have from any of this. And in fact, most of the legal experts and investigators who've looked at the Lockerbie things think that he and Libya were framed for that bombing itself.
I have a little story about this because I was at the European awards ceremony for documentaries and other films in Berlin some years ago. I was invited to speak there. I went to Berlin. It was actually held in a former Nazi headquarters, which was kind of a little creepy. But nevertheless, they showed some great films, and there was a film shown about what happened in Scotland. It was done by, actually, I think Germans, who actually followed this whole thing, and they interviewed everybody in connection with this. And at the end of watching this documentary, done an incredibly detailed investigation, you came away feeling there is no way that the guy who's being convicted of this had anything to do with it, And then it followed that this guy was released, supposedly for humanitarian reasons, by Scottish authorities. A deal was made for Gaddafi to pay reparations. American companies ended up paying a lot of those reparations to the American companies. That the quid pro quo was that, there would be trading and dealing going on with Libya. All of this is very murky. But on the details of the Lockerbie bombing, it seemed to me, I was very persuaded by this film, very impressed by it, You know, because this guy interviewed the CIA people. He interviewed all of the witnesses, okay? It was so thorough. It was amazingly thorough, very detailed. And, you know, you came away feeling like this is a complete frame-up. So you're hardly, you know, barking up the wrong tree here, Russ.
Yeah. And you know what's important, Danny, when you go back and you say, well, what, you know, there's, we're throwing a lot of facts at people, but on the bottom line, what are we looking at here? I think we're looking at the same thing that I think, you know, I wrote the book Family of Secrets, which is the backstory to the rise of the Bush family, what really has been happening to America, not just under them, but for decades. And this is about this larger story that essentially it all comes down to control of natural resources. Almost everything you look at in international relations, that's always the bottom line, whether it's oil or it's mining for a strategic or precious metals, or it is water, whatever it is natural resources. And that is the name of the game. That is mostly what motivates these governments, and not just the U.S. government, but all of the governments. And so when we look at someone like Gaddafi and the fact that he was a fairly independent character like Hugo Chavez and so on, not a likable character by any means, but an independent character with his own influence in that region, not pliant, not necessarily cooperative. Mm-hmm. He was always a target. He was always a problem, and they began having skirmishes with him back in the
80s. They tried to kill him how many times? Yeah. I mean, many times they've killed members of his family,
right?
And while denying that they're targeting him, denying that they're trying to kill a foreign leader. You'll notice that South Africa has tried to create some sort of mediation, some sort of resolution of this problem. It's been rejected by NATO, rejected by the United States. They won't even talk to the South African government about it. Why South Africa? Why are they so concerned about Gaddafi? And I'll tell you why. Because Gaddafi played a role and was very supportive of the liberation struggle in South Africa. That's why Nelson Mandela went to Libya and has praised Gaddafi for his role in helping the democratic process in South Africa achieve, you know, what it has achieved. And, you know, to dismiss all this, to only have to look at him through the eyes of someone who's totally demonized, you know, a dictator, etc., when the people who they're trying to impose on Libya have not been elected by anyone. I mean, today the New York Times reports that $1 billion is being put into a fund for the so-called rebels in Libya, who we don't even know who they are, okay? I told a funny story about one of the rebel leaders who was interviewed by the chief foreign correspondent of NBC, who asked him, well, why are you opposing Libya? He said, I'm opposing Gaddafi because he's Jewish. This is what the guy said, okay? So, I mean, it's there's so much more to this than we are told, and the fact that you had the guts to actually investigate this and to offer another narrative, to raise questions about it, so much more than most of our media has been doing at all. They've just been basically phoning it in, you know, they're just repeating, regurgitating what the government is saying. I mean, Hillary Clinton, he will be gone soon. A week ago, the report was, you know, they're hoping that to oust him by Christmas. And this was something that was supposed to be done in a few days. So I don't think we're getting a full story here at all about Libya. That's why I started by playing Country Joe and the Fish, because, you know, there's some basic resonance here with Vietnam, where we were lied to for so many years, you know, led to this intervention, led to the deaths of so many people. We don't really know the truth about what's happening there, and I think we need to ask deeper questions about it, and I think you are doing that. And what kind of response have you gotten from this?
Huge response. Our traffic at whowhatwhy.com has exploded in the last few days, and it's very interesting because we see it coming from not just, you know, the sort of usual suspects, kind of liberal, progressive site.
Yeah, people
so
like Schechter,
but we're also
guys.
Getting tremendous traffic from the libertarians, who also feel they're being lied to by the government, and from all over the world. We are seeing hits coming in from everywhere, and so we know this needs to be done. We're committed to trying to grow our website, build it up, and the capacity. We want to hire and train more investigative reporters and to work with programs like yours to continue to get these stories out there. The thing that strikes me, Danny, is that And here I am right now in Orlando at a conference of investigative journalists, and these are good people doing good work, but they all self-censor because they work for these large corporate-owned news organizations, and they know in their own minds what they can and cannot do, and they understand the power right now, particularly in this country, of symbols and of buzzwords, and that they just are not strong enough to overcome those. The other problem, by the way, I think, is the partisan press, which I've certainly contributed to over the years. The problem there is that they're really only comfortable with narratives that their readers are familiar with. And so if you come up with something new that cuts against it, they don't want that either. So our goal at whowhatwhy.com is to be truly nonpartisan, but absolutely fierce.
How about postpartisan? You know, if you don't have the latest picture of Mr. Wiener's wiener, you're not getting any attention from a lot of the media. I just would tell you, Wall Street Journal is reporting that U.S. securities regulators are examining whether Goldman Sachs and other financial firms have violated bribery laws in dealing with Libya's sovereign wealth fund, according to people familiar with the matter. And officials are interested in a $50 million fee. Goldman initially agreed to pay the Libyan Sovereign Wealth Fund as part of a proposal by the company to help the fund recoup its losses which they were responsible for, by the way. So, you know, these stories are just beginning to break into the mainstream media. They always start from outsiders like Russ Baker, who are there trying to do, you know, the job that mainstream journalism should be doing. And that's why I think it's important not just to focus on this story, but to introduce your website to our audience and to urge support for your work, because keeping independent media alive is very difficult. Gary Null was just chatting with me a minute ago. He says the number of downloads from the Progressive Radio Network last week were more than from NPR and Pacifica combined. Does that mean that Progressive Radio Network is ready to challenge all the big guys? I don't think so, but it is a sign of interest from the public who are not getting the full story from the people to whom they turn. So I know you have to go back to the conference in Orlando, the Online News Association. Russ, thanks so much. We'll have you back on to talk some more about your work. Give us the website one more time.
Sure. It's whowhatwhy.com.
Russ Baker, everybody. We'll be back in a minute.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
40% of the stations carried no news of the world.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Colt, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say, we don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. A mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news goo.
What we need to know.
News goo.
What we want to know.
Listening to the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
Join me, Rachel.
Rachel Trachtenberg for Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination. This is a show for everyone from our perspective as teens. Current events, art as life, music, and politics. Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination.
With co-host Julia Cunning.
Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Not bad.
Not too shabby.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa, Morgan Stanley, too. In debt we trust, so pay we must, we owe it all to you.
Hey, listening to News Dissector Radio here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, a program heard Fridays at this time from 1 to 2. We welcome your comments. We're going to be posting the whole program on iTunes and also on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website, where you'll be able to get the podcast, download it, share it with your friends. So this is the last show we're going to be doing for a little while because I am off this next week to South Africa and also visiting the Zanzibar International Film Festival. How's that for something really exotic? It's firstly supposedly a very cool place to go, and I'm going to be there, and then I'll be in South Africa through mid-July, and then I'll be back. Hopefully they won't completely kick me off the air here. I'm going to try to get a guarantee from Matt, who's the engineer here, to that effect, but it's he has a lot of the clout in this place, but I don't know if he will agree. At any rate, I played you the anthem, as I do every week, from my film In Debt We Trust, the anthem, the In Debt We Trust anthem, which praises our great banks. I notice one of them no longer is around, Wachovia, but it also praises Citibank. And the news today is that hackers stole personal information for more than 200,000 Citibank credit card holders, one of the largest direct attacks on a major bank. Now, what's interesting about it is that this attack was actually months ago and was not reported, not disclosed by Citibank. And, you know, people are quoted here in the New York Times saying they're not at all on top of it. It's almost shocking. Almost. Now, what would make it shocking? Maybe if there were 300,000 credit card names that were stolen in Washington. Sheila Blair, the chairwoman of the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, said she's planning to call on banks to strengthen their authentication procedures. But lawmakers say they were outraged that Citigroup, which knew about this since early May, waited until now to notify their customers. These banks are a mess. They're running an operation that's, if not criminal, bordering on the criminal, and they really need to be held accountable. That's why financial reform is so important. That's the topic of my blog today on newsdissector.com. Please check it out. And it's also why it's so important to support Elizabeth Warren in her bid to become the chairwoman of this new consumer protection agency, because it looks like the commitment to Warren by the Obama administration is very thin, and in fact they're backing away from supporting her. It's another betrayal in my mind of a commitment to real financial reform. Earlier in the week, I was had the opportunity of sitting in for Professor Mark Crispin Miller at a wonderful bookstore here in New York, McNally Jackson, on Prince Street. This was an event where speakers come on Tuesday nights, first Tuesday of the month, to talk about politics and political issues. And the book that we're going to hear about is called Reviving the Strike, How Working People Can Regain Power and Transform America by Joe Burns. Unfortunately, this event was one that the Green Arrow could not attend. He was extremely busy on that evening, freestyling somewhere, and he did not show. However, I was surprised to find that when the event started, there were about two people in the room. I said, oh, my, this is depressing. I blinked. Within a few minutes, the place was packed by people, many of them members of unions who came to join this conversation. And I hosted it. So Joe Friendly, who does programming on both YouTube and Manhattan Cable, was there shooting all of this. And he's given me a copy of the actual event. And I thought I would play some of it for you so you can I can take you there to the McNally-Jackson bookstore and hear from Joe Burns and hear my introduction of Joe Burns. Dissector and sitting in for Mark Crispin Miller, the NYU professor, who runs these First Tuesday political events here at this bookstore. And Mark couldn't make it tonight and asked me to sub in, maybe because he knew I have an affinity for the subject, having been a shop steward for the UE and also a graduate of the Cornell University School of Labor Relations, London School of Economics, College of Hard Knocks, etc. So I've had some experience as an organizer and as an analyst of economic affairs. Just so you know a little bit about me, I have a new film. I'm a filmmaker as well as a troublemaker, and my new film is called Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. And it looks at the financial crisis as a crime story, not as a business problem. And it also has a companion book, The Crime of Our Time. Anyway, I'm delighted to be here because the topic that Joe is talking about tonight, and I'll introduce Joe in a second, is also very close to me, because I led a strike in Boston at a radio station, which went on for 3 weeks, and which resulted in a complete victory for all of the employees. So I'm somebody who's had experiences with strikes. My father, who was in the Garment Workers Union, was also involved in strikes, as was his father, but they didn't always have that same kind of outcome that the one I was involved in was. But at any rate, Joe comes to us today basically as somebody who has a point of view about how to revitalize the labor movement and how the labor movement and working people have to begin embracing the strike in a more aggressive way than has happened over the last, you know, decades or so, where we've gone from hundreds of strikes involving hundreds of thousands of workers to a handful of strikes. Joe is a veteran union negotiator. He's a labor lawyer. He's a former local union president. For the past decade, he's negotiated labor contracts in the airline and healthcare industries. He has a law degree from the New York University Law School, is that right?
That's right.
And so he's very well credentialed, he's very well experienced, and he's very angry about what's going on. He also, as you read his book, Reviving the Strike, which I did before this talk tonight, I found that one of the lessons, and at least one filmmaker in the audience will be interested in this, that he, as a college student in the mid-80s, traveled to Austin, Minnesota, to join a picket line of striking meatpackers at Hormel, and was part of that struggle, which really energized a lot of people in the Midwest, and a lot of Americans learned about it through the film American Dream, and the issues that it raised are still with us today, not just the activities of the unions, but also of veteran organizers like Ray Rogers, who was attempting to create corporate campaigns to support the labor campaigns. So Joe Burns, welcome to this wonderful bookstore. Thank you so much for having us here. And why don't you give us a little kind of summary of your perspective, and then I'll have some questions. We're supposed to have a conversation, but I can recede as you step forward with your point of view.
Okay. Let me just give you a little overview of the book and how I came to write it. Basically, when I started out, I didn't really intend to write a book about the strike or one titled Reviving the Strike. I was originally a lot more interested in labor law and how it operated as a system of labor control. But as I continued in my research for the book, I became more and more interested in labor history and labor economics. And a lot of what I could tell for the problems of the labor movement seemed to be that we had abandoned some fundamental principles of traditional labor economics and theory. And when you look at it, for the first 150 years of trade unionism here in the United States, the strike was the centerpiece of trade union strategy. In fact, if you went back and told people that you were going to have a labor movement not based on a strike, even conservative trade unionists would look at you as being odd. The strike was, as economist Albert Rees declared in 1962, by far the most important source of union power. And in fact, when you look from the period of the greatest union strength in this country, from the 1930s well into the 1970s, what you see is that the trade unionists, through collective bargaining backed by a powerful strike, were able to construct a powerful labor movement which was capable of transforming the lives of an entire generation of working people, both union and non-union. The unions, through strikes, were able to transform the wage structures in entire industries. So you take an industry like meatpacking or trucking, and what you see is thousands of workers striking at once, not like the isolated strikes of today, and in doing so, able to forge a powerful labor movement. So one of the things I looked at was, why is it that the strike was so powerful back then, and today, obviously, the strike is not something feared by employers, it's something often feared by workers. And the reason is the strike today differs fundamentally from the traditional strike of the labor movement. The traditional strike of the labor movement had two key features to it in order to be successful. And you can tell this by, you know, not only studying labor history, but also looking at economics textbooks from the 1950s through the 1980s. And what you'll find is that there's two key features, as I said, to the strike. The first is workplace-based solidarity, meaning workers acted together across workplaces and industries. And the second was that a strike was capable of stopping production. So let's just take a couple seconds and look at these key factors here. Solidarity is the heart and soul of trade unionism. Yet today, the solidarity that we're able to legally employ is a pale imitation of the solidarity employed by trade unionists. That's because today's solidarity is you do fundraisers, and a lot of the trade unionists here have probably participated where you do fundraisers for workers who are on strikes, or maybe you join their picket lines. But in the past, workers were able to band together as workers in their workplaces and exercise a deep and powerful form of solidarity. And there are really three elements to that solidarity. The first is industry-wide strikes. When you think of the great strikes of trade union history, the Bread and Roses strike of the textile workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts in the 1910s, or you look at the strike wave of 1946 where hundreds of thousands of mine workers joined hundreds of thousands of steel workers and hundreds of thousands of auto workers all striking at the same time and winning the same 18.5 cent wage increase. What you find is they didn't strike one workplace at a time. They struck entire industries at once. The second point with workplace-based solidarity that workers were able to use is they had what's now called by the law secondary strikes and secondary boycotts. And an example of a secondary strike would be, let's say I strike brewery workers. We go on strike, and we're striking a beer. What we would do in the old days is we would go set up a picket line at the local bar, and we would ask the bartenders union to go out on strike, not in support of their own demands, but in support of us as fellow workers. And you saw that form of solidarity be so effective that it allowed a highly fragmented industry such as trucking in the 1930s with thousands and thousands of independent contractors. It allowed the Teamsters Union to build a powerful contract that benefited generations of working class Americans. And they were able to do that through secondary activity. But then what you find is that employers understood this, and I think they've always understood something far better than trade unionists. What they understood was that if they win one strike, they've only defeated that union in that particular battle. But what they determined was if they could change the rules of the game, they could win strike after strike after strike. And what we're seeing them doing, we're seeing that phenomenon play out again in the public sector today, where they're going after the laws governing collective bargaining in state after state.
Joe, can I yeah. throw in a question here?
Sure.
If that's okay.
Yeah.
At some point along the way, not only did the employers become more sophisticated in their tactics and the use of their propaganda outfits and the use of the media, but it seems like the unions themselves began to change their outlook. They wanted to be accepted. They wanted to find a base of cooperation with management. They wanted to, find a way to limit conflict manage conflict rather than exacerbate conflict. How did that happen, and how do you account for it?
Well, I think what you saw is that the period after the tumultuous 1930s, you saw trade unionism become institutionalized for a number of decades. And you saw after the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, you saw the Cold War and the driving out of the left wing of the labor movement. And in doing so, many of the ideas that are necessary for successful trade unionism were eliminated, and many unions became conservative and complacent. So when you jump forward, and although you still had a fair degree of strike activity during this period, but a lot of it was fairly routine. When you came to the employer offensive of the 1980s, what you found were unions who were completely incapable of dealing with the employer offensive.
There was also a way in which, certain pattern bargaining started, in auto, one company would be singled out as opposed to a strike against the whole industry to try to set the standard. And that sort of inevitably divides workers also because, some people are working, some people aren't working. What was the kind of strategic or ideological reasons for this?
You saw different vehicles in different industries, but basically the general idea during this period of the 1930s through the 70s and even before the 1910s, the general idea was to standardize wages in the industry. And what trade unionists understood was that you could not have stable trade unionism unless you were able to, through a number of vehicles, standardize wages. Because otherwise you get what happens today, such as in the airline industry. Even though you've got extremely high levels of unionization, some unions have better contracts than the others and basically undercut if a union is successful in winning pensions and benefits and so forth, then they're undercut by their lower wage competitors. So I think that's what you saw in the auto industry. They use pattern bargaining, but in the in trucking and steel, they formed these multi-employer agreements. What you saw during the 1980s was a complete destruction of the patterns. And I think Kim Moody from Labor Notes has written a fair degree on this about how what happened became a race to the bottom, where union locals undercut locals even in their own union and industry.
What about the role of sort of, how you put it, like consumption? The way, you know, working people who had regarded themselves maybe as workers now were also defined as consumers. And, you know, we're going into debt to buy, to join the middle class, to be part of the middle class. And part of that seems to have led to a loss of militancy or a loss of ideology in labor. In other words, it was everybody who was out for themselves more than working together towards a common goal.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at it, and at least in my own experience, there is a latent militancy out there among the working class. And I think you saw that tapped into in Madison, where you had tens of thousands of people, once they saw that there was a vehicle to fight back, stood up and fight back. I think what you saw during the 1980s was it wasn't a problem that the union members weren't willing to fight back and take a stand. And you saw that in industry after industry, whether it was Greyhound, whether it was Hormel, which you mentioned, in meatpacking, whether it was Phelps Dodge in mining. The problem is when workers did fight back, one, they weren't supported in all too many cases by their international unions, and two, they fought back utilizing the rules of a rigged game. And they would basically...
Well, that's Joe Burns. Joe Burns and I had this conversation. The whole program lasted about an hour. We can't play the whole thing for you here. But it was an interesting insight. And what I was particularly struck by were the various workers who came and raised questions. One of the members of the Transport Workers Union, somebody else from Local 32B from the Bronx, the building service workers. Teachers, an adjunct professor at NYU, who are finding, you know, it hard to sustain unionism, in part because, you know, the people are so distracted, they're not really focused on supporting each other, the culture is really hostile to people thinking of themselves as workers with rights. You know, we're in a situation just this week where, you know, Governor Cuomo has announced, you know, he wants to kind of kill pensions for public service workers, to set up a new tier so that new young workers don't get the same pension rights that other people had, you know, which means that we're getting into a situation of downward mobility, shrinking revenues for working people, really squeezing, if not killing, the middle class. And this is all being done at the behest, as Mr. Krugman writes today in the New York Times, of the people who own the bonds, who are the credit rentiers, he calls them, who basically want to get paid and don't care about anybody else sharing in any of the wealth or any of the prosperity in America. And this is basically happening at a time when not only are unions isolated, but other people who consider themselves progressives are not supporting unions. I remember watching Keith Olbermann when he was on MSNBC a while back. He's now starting his new show on Current TV. After his fight with and basic eviction from MSNBC. But at one point, he introduced Mr. Trumka, Rich Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO. And he says, "We're so glad for you to join us." And it was clear this was Trumka's first appearance on MSNBC. The leader of millions of workers hadn't even been on the air before. And so labor's voice is not heard. It's not heard in the media. It's not heard very much. And that's why today I wanted you to hear from Joe Burns, the book again, Reviving the Strike, How Working People Can Regain Power and Transform America. It was a very enlightening discussion, and I hope we'll have more of them. I'm just leaving a few minutes here at the end to give you my email again, Danny@mediachannel.org, if you want to write. newsdissector.com has been my blog, but we're going to be sort of going fishing for a while. I'm off to Africa next week. I want to thank some of the folks who have helped me produce this program. One of them is no longer with us, Sherry Welch, but Kat Waters is here. You were telling me about some Bilderberg meeting happening in Switzerland. I wish we could send you there to cover it for News Dissector Radio. That would be cool, right? You'd really freak them out.
Yeah, the Swiss, they want to arrest Henry Kissinger as a war criminal at Bilderberg. It says at the Hotel Servette House in Saint-Maurice, if he attends. The Swiss People's Party representative Dominique Bettig wrote a letter to the general prosecutor of the Swiss Federation in which he asks Henry Kissinger in the name of cantonal sovereignty and independence, but especially of the justice's independence from executive power.
All right, at any rate, the point is to try to arrest Henry Kissinger. They wanted to do it the other night over at the 92nd Street Y, but it didn't really happen. Green Arrow, the freestyling rapper who's been working with us, is in the studio. You're going to get a little time off now, away from my constant demands that you meet deadlines and the like.
Yes. I was wondering, did you ever hear that song by Gil Scott-Heron, Message to the Messengers? He talks about, if they start calling you insane and say you got no brain and call you scarecrow, that's the same thing they said about us a long time ago. They say you lost your nerve. That's what they said about Johannesburg. So I was hoping maybe we could inspire some people out there to stand up for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, the Arrow and I, both of us went to a memorial service for Gil Scott-Heron at the Riverside Church. And it was really impressive, very moving. His daughter Gia spoke and read a poem to her dad, and may emerge as the next Heron, on the music scene, because she was very passionate, and we were all very impressed and moved by her contribution. Gil Scott-Heron, of course, was an important voice, showing that music, culture, poetry can be about something, can be about social change, can be about calling out the people who are doing evil in this world, and calling on people of goodwill to get together, to unite, and to move forward together. And that's what I think we've been trying to do here on News Dissector Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. Let me hear from you on email. I'm off to South Africa. Wish me bon voyage. I'll be seeing my daughter this weekend, so it'll be a happy Father's Day to be with her. And I'll be back as soon as I can, and I'm looking forward to this trip to South Africa, and I'll have more to tell you about it when I get back. Thanks again for listening, and we'll be back when we're back.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got dulled when Wall Street stepped into the fold. Congress paid off, workers paid off. Stanford, AIG, and Madoff. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets.